At the Organ, a weekly show about the classical organ and its music, heard on organlive.com every Sunday or streaming from our website anytime. Just point your browser to attheorgan.com for more information. Now, let's hear what's happening this week at the Organ.
Hello and welcome to At the Organ. My name is Brent Johnson. Today is May 13th, 2012, and we are joined by organ builder Patrick Murphy. Hello, Patrick. Welcome to At the Organ.
Hi, Brent. Thanks so much for having me on your program. It's a delight to be here.
Pat is the president and artistic director of Patrick J. Murphy & Associates Organ Incorporated, a pipe organ company located in Stowe, Pennsylvania. Pat joins us from his office there. Where exactly is Stowe?
Well, Stowe, Pennsylvania is in eastern Pennsylvania. We're about 30 miles west of Philadelphia, 9 miles east of Reading. So we're in eastern Pennsylvania, about 2 hours of south of New York City and about 2 hours north of Baltimore.
How long have you been in business there?
We've been in business since 1987, which this year marks our 25th anniversary, we're happy to say. A quarter of a century is now behind us, and a lot of experience has been gained by it.
Well, congratulations on that milestone. Tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got into organ building.
Well, I began, like anybody else, listening to the instrument. I was exposed to it early on, and when I was about 12 or 13, I got into the pipe organ just quite by accident when my father had a Virgil Fox recording that he was playing at home. My mother wasn't home, so the stereo was turned up very loud, and I was really impressed by listening to the large tubas and very rich choruses and 32-foot reed stops, of course, rattling away. It was something I had never experienced before, and it was after that event that I went to see a Virgil Fox in concert during the 70s. This was during the heavy organ days when he was playing Bach with a touring electronic organ, and I was really impressed with Virgil's playing and his style, and I thought I wanted to become an organist, but I learned early on that I really needed to know more about the instrument, and so I began to delve into everything I could find about the pipe organ, going to see instruments, knocking on churches' doors, reading books, anything I could find, because this is before computers, as you know, and so I had to go to the library. But I discovered early on there were many organists who couldn't build and many builders who don't play. And I felt that in order to really understand what I wanted to know, I had to learn some disciplines in both areas. Well, first piano lessons, then organ lessons with Albert Robinson, who was one of the founders of the Organ Historical Society. And the OHS was a tremendous influence to me early on. So that led me to study the organ, and I received a Bachelor of Music degree in organ performance from Ohio Wesleyan. Then I went to work for various builders and learned quite a bit, as I say, with apprenticing. And then I began my firm in 1987, quite almost by accident. It had been my desire to start a business, but literally overnight we were in business due to one contract that was awarded to us.
When you got that first one contract, did you have a staff assembled, or did you have to rush to find friends to help you out?
Well, the second half of your question is more like it. There was a bit of scrambling. No, the first contract, I was it. I was the, as they say, the head bottle washer and everything else associated with it. No, those early years, I was the entire company, me, myself, and I. No, the first contract that was awarded to me was actually a fire job. It was a 1884 Roosevelt that had been through a fire, literally. And we were awarded the contract to restore it from severe water damage, and it was quite a process. Fortunately, I had builders in the trade who I subcontracted certain large components to them and did most of the pipework repair and final assembly in my shop. It took about a year to do, and then I did all the assembly on site pretty much by myself and hung my hat on it. And the organ is still functioning today in the church in Philadelphia, I'm happy to say, and we still take care of it.
It seems like we don't hear about many organ builders today that really do every single part of the instrument, pipes, woodworking, you know, consoles, everything. You have individuals within the company that have their specialties, but has that been a benefit to you to know every single element of the instrument?
You have to wear many hats in this business. That's just very, very key. If you're going to be successful in any business, you need to know a little bit about everything and specialize in some areas. Early on, I just knew that where I wanted to go as a builder, but knew that it was very important to me to understand all the disciplines, or at least understand the general concepts and concentrate on what I wanted to do with my final product. And then seek people to work with who are talented, skilled, and a pleasure to be around. And from that concept is how I built my firm into what it is today. We have a staff of 12 people now, and it's a fun place to work, and that's really, really important. The motto around here is that we believe very strongly in 51% personality and 49% talent. And that's really important because skill and talent, you're born with talent, skill you can acquire, personality, you either have it or you don't. But we have a very a wonderful assemblage of craftspeople, men and women here, who all have specialty skills in different areas. Some are woodworkers, some are wiring people, some are organ tuners, some are finish people, but building a pipe organ is a collaborative effort. And the important thing is that the one person in charge of the company, in this case myself, my job is to envision the product for the customer, to take the customer's wishes and to interpret them, or to certainly digest them and explain them into the staff, so that the final result is an instrument of craft and integrity that meets and hopefully exceeds the expectations of the client.
If we were to pay a visit to your shop today, tell us what we'd find there.
Well, right now we've got a lot of activity. I was walking through the shop just a few minutes before you called, and there's just a lot of activity, a lot of hub of activity. I wish you could see it. We have an instrument under construction right now, a new instrument for St. Elizabeth's Roman Catholic Church in Carnegie, Pennsylvania, which is just basically Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, eastern Pennsylvania. This is a new instrument of 22 stops, three manuals. And the thing that's unusual about it is at the client's request, they preferred to use pipe work that was not in their instrument. This is a Catholic church that has been refurbished, and their instrument was, instead of being refurbished, we're using portions of the old case, and we're using mostly repurposed pipe work, and that was at the client's request, and we have no problem with that. And it's a very good exercise in taking very good quality components, polishing them as you were, to the highest possible tonal ability, and then making a musical instrument out of it. Something we don't do too often, but we're happy to do it. And the end result is going to be an instrument that's mechanically reliable and musically satisfying. It certainly still follows the tenets that we try to do, and that is instruments that are going to excite and soothe. And that's a very exciting project. It's a wonderful room, seats about 300 people, good acoustics, very fine people to work with. We have that ongoing. And then after that, we have a three-manual 39-stop instrument for Trinity Lutheran Church in Reading, Pennsylvania, just 9 miles from the shop here. We're all excited about that. That's an all-new instrument, with including a new case. It'll also incorporate our signature drawn-out console, which all of our projects generally do. New projects, I should say, and that's going to go in. That's going to be under construction later this year, and then after that, we have a large rebuild down in Baltimore at Zion Lutheran Church in Baltimore, Maryland. They have a molar that we're going to rebuild, retaining a few pipes from the molar, but it'll be all new mechanicals, new cases, as it were, and a substantial job after that. A substantial job to do. And then after that, we have three rebuilds for next year, a Reuter instrument and a molar, which is very interesting. The molar contains pipe work from 1900, the previous instrument, Mueller and Abel Company, which was an outgrowth of the Roosevelt Organ Company in New York City. And we're going to be restoring all the pipe work to its original 1900 sound, and then restoring the 1940s molar mechanism to accept the pipe work, and then we're going to upgrade the console, keep the molar console, but put new appointments on it. So that's a thumbnail of what's happening, and we're of course very, very pleased to have this much work, and we're very pleased to have this many clients entrust us with their viable instruments.
Indeed, it sounds like you're going to be very busy in the coming years. Tell us about those signature draw knob consoles you mentioned. What makes them signature?
Well, it's something that was an outgrowth of years and years. I understand clearly that the console is where well, the organist hits, puts on their seatbelt and drives the thing. And that's important. But when you go to many locations, you find more and more that the organist and choir master is a single person position. And my observations came from years and years of doing service work. That's pretty much where I got my first training, was being in the field, tuning instruments, servicing instruments, learning from instruments, both good and bad, and seeing consoles that were, some were fun to play, some were very elegant and easy to play, and some that were real pieces of work as far as craft, but kind of impractical when trying to see the choir and to get a good sight of line with the musicians and try to get communication. So what we've developed is a console that is very practical. It's a drawn-up console, very elegant, all the latest state-of-the-art features, easy to move. And our console design is in a component system where the bases are all the same, and the top of the console can accommodate a 2-manual or a 3-manual vertical draw knob or horizontal draw knob. But the console is somewhat low so that the organist can easily see over the top of the console to any of the choir director, choir persons, I should say, or the musicians in order to communicate their directives for the music.
I notice a number of your projects are rebuilds of existing organs. Is it challenging when you're given an instrument to work with that was not of your design? And how do you go about then making it a successful instrument while still honoring the original design and original intent of the instrument?
First of all, the goal is that the client wants an instrument that is mechanically reliable. It has to be mechanically reliable. Secondly, it has to, in order to be mechanically reliable, you've got to be able to get in and out of the instrument and service it and tune it. If you can't service it like your car, if you can't service your motor, if your mechanic can't do their job, then its life will be shortened. So those are two starting criteria. A third criteria, of course, is what we think of as, of course, the sound. How successful is it in the room? And there are many times for which there are obstacles, either architectural obstacles, the chamber isn't big enough for an instrument adequately to fit the room adequately. There's a window we have to work around. Things like that. Instruments built by other people, I just simply have to sit down there and play it and judge if it is musically satisfying. Usually when I go into a project, I do that first without asking the client, does this instrument do its job for you? If you're happy with it, fine. If there are problems you don't like, let's talk about it. And if there are problems that they can identify that are the same problems that I have picked up on my first visit, then I know we're on the right track. But I think it's important that every instrument project, when it's finished, have a great degree of integrity within the instrument. You know, organists are only given the task of being an organist at a church for a very short time, but the instrument belongs to the client, the church building, and it's going to be there for a long time. And so we're very keen on trying to have instruments of integrity. So when you sit there and play it, you say, this is a musical instrument, and it's whether its pedigree is somewhat checkered or if it's a purpose-built from day one, you can have instruments that are new from the get-go that aren't as successful, and instruments that are built with parts that have come in over its years that are successful. So those are key things, and how we determine how to maintain integrity.
You're listening to At the Organ.
We're talking with organ builder Patrick Murphy, who joins us today from his office in Stowe, Pennsylvania. Pat, you build both mechanical action and electrical action instruments. Do you have a personal preference, or is it based on the style of instrument you're trying to create?
Well, let me correct you. Actually, we do not build mechanical action instruments. However, we gladly and happily restore mechanical action instruments, and I've done several. I probably have about 24 Hook or Hook and Hastings organs to my credit, two Roosevelts, and several other instruments of mechanical action, the oldest being the Tannenberg organ in Spring City, Pennsylvania, which we did a historic restoration on. So we don't build mechanical action, but we have a lot of history restoring mechanical action instruments. Electric action organs we do is our primary source of work these days. Every project has to come down with what I myself would want to play every Sunday. What do I want to play every Sunday? And so I try to be pragmatic in every project. And so I really do prefer, in my case, electric action. And we do build our own electric slider chests. We build everything in-house here. We do not actually make pipes, but we do all the scaling and voicing here in-house. And so we have the ability to build most of the instrument in-house and then have great control over the quality and results of the instrument at the end.
Looking back on your 25 years in business, what has been the biggest change in your process or in your design ideas that's come about in the past 25 years?
There's been several changes. I think the first one that comes to my mind was, we alluded to early on, I did begin my career as a restorer of mechanical action instruments, and I'm still, as I say, glad to do that. But I evolved from a mechanical action restorer to a producer of new organs and a quality rebuilder of older instruments, older electric action instruments, I should say. That was a big change. I think that came to the fact that we talk about artistic elements of instruments, but there's also a business side that's very, very important. Organ building must succeed as a business if it's going to survive as an art. I've had to also evolve into the overall producer. In my shop, you might say, I'm really work most as a producer and a director. I direct the artistic decisions, direct the final outcome, sometimes have to make changes which are difficult in the production, but that have to be made in order to get a good result. But always being mindful of giving the client what it is they're after and hopefully exceeding their expectations. At the same time, we're trying to be true to ourselves and running a good business that is straightforward, honest, and productive. And so that's certainly one I've had, something that was never taught to me. I never took a single business course in my life, but my family is from a business family, and that's one that we've had to learn how to involve in. I think that the other thing that artistically has been a challenge is the electronic or hybrid organ, which was around when I was younger, but it's grown into its own thing now. We are members of the Associated Pipe Organ Builders of America, which is the top 30 companies and suppliers in the country. And our code basically does allow electronic 32s, 16s, and percussions, but does not condone other electronic voices into, especially the chorus, any kind of manual stop, I should say. And we try to stick to that code. Fortunately, the wolf is not under our door, so I guess we're doing something right. But that's been one of the biggest challenges, because clients believe that they're getting a good value for their money for having a hybrid organ. In my opinion, I don't believe that is so, because we are seeing some earlier generation instruments that are simply having issues as they become older, and that the pipe elements always will far outlast the electronic elements if it's done well. You know, the one thing that has to be really important too in many instances is that Sunday morning is often the only time the average person gets to listen to live music by a real person on a real instrument. That's a tremendous cultural responsibility that churches have. And I think that any client who wants to really give their congregant something you can't get anywhere else, I think that music in church, music in society, is such a battleground these days. And I think that we sometimes get a little... The purpose of an instrument in church doing supporting congregational singing, accompanying choir, and playing liturgy gets kind of blurred as an instrument that just only does liturgy. I think it's important that it's there to do a job, and that's the most important thing of all.
Let's go back and talk about your history and involvement with the Oregon Historical Society. How did that institution influence your thoughts about organs and organ building?
Well, I was the first recipient of the E. Para Biggs Fellowship Award in 1978 when I was still in high school. And that enabled me to go to an OHS convention free of charge. I've been to many, many, many OHS conventions and have seen, I don't know how many instruments at these conventions. By that exposure to older instruments of the 19th century, I was able to hear instruments, as I say before, that some are successful, some are not. One of the biggest moments for me, I think, was listening to the 1866 Hook in Newburyport. Peter Sykes played a recital. It was a room, a typical American church, with negative acoustics, just better than a doornail. Everything was padded. The room just, nothing could possibly make any effect in it. And the hook was a glorious instrument. It was exciting. It was, it really did well. And it proved to me that there is a way that the hook organs, for example, knew how to fill the typical dead acoustic in American room adequately. And so it could be done. And so those kinds of sounds, those early American 19th century sounds, excited me, made me realize that this is a model. American organs of the 19th century have a lot to offer that I think are often overlooked. We think of the rich history in Europe, and it's very, you know, deservedly so, no doubt about it. But the history here in the States is every bit as proud and successful as it is has been in Europe, just not as old, of course. But by going to OHS conventions, and I've also served on council for two occasions, it gave me an insight of not only what the instrument has to do, but it gave me an insight as to how a fine society like the OHS exists. And it gave me the opportunity to help in promoting its cause.
The audio feed for the rest of this interview was a bit distorted, so we're going to switch back to the feed of our telephone system here. I ask a lot of different organ builders this, and I get different answers every time. If somebody comes to you and says, I'm interested in becoming an organ builder, what advice would you give them?
The first thing, of course, is you don't get wealthy in this business. You simply don't get rich in this business. You can make a living, but you don't get rich in this business. It's very important to understand you've got to have some degree of skill. Passion is the first thing. There's no question about it. You've got to love what you do. But you also need to have some degree of some sort of skill. Many people that want to get into organ building to primarily do to be a voicer, and that's okay. I think the first thing you do is to learn how to tune. Learn how to tune a pipe organ. Learn how to go out into the road, how to do service work. That's awfully important. I learned so much for the many, many, many years I was out tuning and servicing instruments for myself, for other people. There's just a tremendous amount of exposure. It's really was like working in the trenches. You see that, and again, you can understand and what's successful and some things that that are not so successful. And you see tricks that builders have done behind the scenes, and they're good tricks. They're ways to overcome problems. You know. When I first got into the business myself, a mentor to me said to me that if you want to be an organ builder, it's a wonderful, wonderful business because there are very, very few trades you'll ever come across that offer the amount of challenge and variety that pipe organ building does. So people that want to get into organ building, I tell them first learn, you know, get with an apprenticeship program, get with a builder who you really think is doing the right work because there are bad habits there that can be learned. And you don't want bad habits. Learn how to tune. Learn how to service work. Learn how the thing works. Respect all instruments. If you had to have one of the basic skills, it'd be woodworking. There's a lot of woodworking in the organ building business. But, you know, you have to wear many hats, woodworkers, architecture, wiring, things like that. It's all part of the whole. And basically a good work ethic is awfully important, too. There are long hours. Not only in the shop, but when you're on the road installing and doing service work, the work is done when the work is done. And sometimes we put in, you know, 12, 14, 16-hour days. Not regularly, because we believe in a life outside of business, outside of work. But there are those times you've got deadlines to meet, and that's how it has to be.
When you were yourself an apprentice and learning organ building, who were some of your mentors?
Some of my mentors, when I was an organ performance student, I spent a summer working for Fritz Nowak, and learned a tremendous amount that summer with Fritz. Ray Brunner in Lancaster, Al Heller, at the time his partner in business, were tremendous. Al taught me most of my woodworking abilities, and he was a very good teacher. Albert Robinson, as I say, one of the founders of the OHS, was there. I have to think hard about that because my life has been, happy to say it, I've crossed paths with many people who have been very, very kind to me and have given me a lot of their time. I also think of organist too. Keith Chapman from Wanamaker's was a tremendous influence on me early on. He took a lot of time. I would go to the store and sit at the organ on Saturday mornings when he would play, and then he would finish up, turn the light off, have a cup of tea, and and listen to this, 13-year-old kid asking questions, and Keith was very kind to give me his attention. It meant a lot to me. So Keith Chapman was certainly a mentor. There are other people too. I could think of Alan Loftman from the Oregon Clearinghouse, who's now deceased. Alan was a tremendous influence on me. Again, I could think of so many other people. There actually were mentors that I've never met. People that I've read about in the Oregon trade magazines, who I think have done fine work. I've never met Ernest Skinner. He was a tremendous influence. The Hook brothers were a tremendous influence. So was Wilbur Roosevelt. These are all important people. Mentoring is something that you can pick up not only from one-to-one interaction, but mentoring can be picked up just from studying and looking at their work and reading between the lines and getting a feel as to what the integrity of the work is all about. Once you can figure out what the integrity is, then you can say, you know what, you were a mentor.
So you said it's not all business. What do you like to do when you're not building organs?
Well, thank you. I have other hobbies. I have a family, and the family is a wonderful thing for me. I've got two grown sons now, and they're doing their own thing. And I also am very involved with trains, but I'm involved with inch and a half scale live steam. So I actually have two 1/8 inch scale steam locomotives that operate on coal and water, and they operate on just like the full size or just smaller. And anything to do with pipe organs and railroads is pretty much where I'm at. And I actually kind of study the visual things of pipe organ case designs. Always excite me, and actually the designs of American locomotives, steam locomotives, I find a lot of the lines and a lot of the way that they're designed, much like some people are into cars. When they look at certain stylings of automobiles, I look at the stylings of steam locomotives and critique on how they work and how they function. And so that's kind of a strange thing, but I've found out there are a lot of people in my trade who share this as well.
You know, it's funny you say that, because certainly you're not the only organ builder I know who has this interest in trains. And for years, I've been trying to figure out the connection between the two.
You know, it's really interesting. And I will tell you, the thing that is really more unusual is when I go to train meets, the number of train people who are organ buffs. That's what I find really unusual. There's a crossover there that's very, very strong and very, very active. I guess something to do with either nostalgia or complicated musical instruments or a complicated machine, I should say. From the day that I was 14 and opened up the back doors of an organ and discovered the world of wood, metal, and mechanics, looking at trains and looking at machinery and metal and things that move the earth, whether it's by weight or by sound. I think that's what we'll all find so intriguing.
Pat, thank you very much. Where can our listeners find some more information about you and your company?
You can visit us, of course, at www.pjmorgans.com. And we're always happy to hear from you and happy to receive inquiries. We have some recordings. We've got two recordings available through the Raven label. And have another recording that's going to be in production, we hope, this fall, of our instrument down in St. Patrick's in New Orleans, and that's going into final arrangements now. But if you're ever in Philadelphia, if you're visiting winemakers of that area, please come on by the shop. Come pay us a visit. Be happy to show you around and show you some of our instruments, and we'd be delighted to make your acquaintance.
Thank you for joining us today for this interview. We will have links to Patrick J. Murphy Organ's website on our website at theorgan.com, where you can comment on this show, hear other back episodes, find our Facebook page or our Twitter feed, and you can send us email. We'd love to hear your thoughts about this interview and who else you'd like us to find and talk to. Thanks for joining me today. My name is Brent Johnson, and I'll meet you here next week at The Organ.
You've been listening to At The Organ, a weekly look at the art and music of the classical organ. We'd love to hear your comments about the show. Send your email to info@theorgan.com or just go to our website where you can comment on the show. There you can also hear this week's show again or find back episodes. The address is attheorgan.com. At The Organ is a production of the Organ Media Foundation. For more information about supporting the foundation or sponsoring an episode of At The Organ, go to organmedia.org. Thank you for listening, and we'll meet you here next week at The Organ.